I am so glad you could join us. I'm your host, Mo Gaudat. This podcast is nothing more than a conversation between two good friends sharing inspiring life stories and perhaps some nuggets of wisdom along the way. This is your invitation to slow down with us. Welcome to Slow Mo. Welcome back. Today's guest is not the person that you meet every day. She started her first business when she was 11, an import-export business at 11, and then she went to Harvard, Stanford, and Cambridge. She's now a very, very renowned venture capitalist in Silicon Valley. She's the CEO and the global partner of Street Global. She hosts a radio show that is called the Global Fireside Chat, which simply brings industry titans from all over the world and reaches a million people. She is a United Nations Women Empower Women champion, and she recently wrote a book. So we have a ton to talk about. Her book is called Unemployable. I think she's very employable, if you ask me, but the book is called Unemployable, How I Hired Myself. And I felt that this was a topic that is actually very, very timely for our world today, with all of the changes that are happening around AI, the economic challenges that we face, and so on. But most importantly, I have to say, when we got in touch the first time, Alicia Silberg and myself, I did what I normally do and stalked her. I looked at her work, I looked at her background and experience, and I found in her an amazing mix of someone who's driven to succeed, but also is looking at life to reflect and see what impact she can leave behind. So I think we're going to be having a wonderful conversation today, Alicia Silberg. Alicia, thank you so much for joining me. You're in LA now, right?
That's right. And thank you for hosting me. I'm incredibly excited to be joining you. From the moment we started engaging, I was like, this is my person. I want to have an amazing conversation. I want to learn. And I've just been really excited. So thank you.
Yeah, I felt the same. I have to admit, there are those barriers that you get in social media when you're texting someone on LinkedIn or Instagram and so on. But you had that very, very lively energy to you in text format. I mean, today is the first time we meet, and now I understand. It's like, you know, it's like flooding out of you in a way that it has to sort of stay in the text a little bit, which I find quite interesting because you seem to be the typical die-hard, push, hardworking, math kind of person who's running a very tough business. How is that possible? How do you mix the two?
It's been an interesting journey. And I think if you ask why I called the book Unemployable, it comes down to the fact that I had imposter syndrome. And I think that plagued me my entire life. And so that imposter syndrome manifested itself in very unusual ways. Let's take, for example, the joy I get out of texting with someone like you, and that energy, which is real. Like when I connect with someone who's just like me, I let down my guard and I want to engage because you wired the same way as me. And for a long time, I got a lot of negative feedback around that. I was told, you can't be that way. You can't use exclamation marks. You can't be warm. You can't be bubbly. You can't be all these things. And inside of me, that's who I was. Like, I have a joy for life, a gratitude for life. We only live once. We only have a certain amount of time. We should enjoy it. And at the same time, my life's work, the greatest thing I love doing is building companies. So while my first official building business was at 11 years old, building an import-export business with my brother, my first small business was at 5 years old. And that was to get a set of pink roller skates. I wanted pink roller skates and I couldn't afford them and I had to find a way to get them. And so I sold my dad's old Hollywood suits on the side of the road. Oh, and there's a whole story in the book about it. But for me, I've always been like these two parts of the same person. And the idea that I could be that person was that journey that I went on, and being proud of that person and not being ashamed of all these different elements of myself. And that's a large part of why I wrote the book, which was saying, as you said so well, we're going through very strange times, difficult economic times. On the one hand, we're living in the most exciting time in history. On the other hand, we're seeing a lot of things that for many, many people are very scary. And the idea that I shared my story when I've been through so many difficult times to say to other people out there, if I can do it, and I've been shot, I've been through all these things, you know, I've had these things happen to me. If I can do it, so can you. And I want you on that journey with me. So let's go for it.
Oh, that's amazing. I mean, interestingly, Alicia, I think what I feared, so I'm very, very protective of slow-mo. I mean, most of my listeners will know that because I'm not looking for celebrities or big names or big images. Of course, I get quite a few of them, but I'm looking for a human with a heart. And if you don't mind me saying, that has changed. But the first time I read about you, to start a business at 11, I was like, shouldn't a kid at 11 be playing? I mean, this woman might be a little too serious for me, right? And obviously, no, I mean, you're not too serious for, you are very serious, but you're not too serious for me. You're very serious with a passion for making a change, and you're wonderful as a human being at the same time. So that's a very interesting mix. But how does a childhood that starts so focused on business, how is that a childhood at all?
Thank you for saying that. It means a great deal. And I appreciate how much thought you gave to my life. Like, you really are a very deep person. You know, I come from Pretoria, South Africa. And
I was thinking that accent is, it's not American. So, yeah.
It's not American. And there's someone, everyone knows who comes from Pretoria. And I think it's a very good analogy to answer your question. Elon Musk comes from Pretoria. He grew up a few streets away from where my family had our shop and my family lived. From what I can tell, it all comes naturally to Elon. It just like flows out of him building companies. For me, it wasn't like that. For me, it was survival. So I grew up very poor. And you touched on something very deep because I had a lot of personal work to do. Like when you were asking about this combination of energy and drive in your earlier question. And it wasn't a real childhood. There was survival. And I think that was why it was so important for me to write the book, because there's so many people, especially like in the emerging markets, but I'm seeing a lot of that now in the US, which, you know, as I speak with like Gen Z in the US, a lot of what we've experienced growing up in the emerging markets, Gen Z is now experiencing, which is a very unusual set of circumstances to be experiencing as somebody that grew up in Africa, to see a lot of the same economic challenges and structural challenges taking place. But you're 100% right. It was like I almost became like a machine. And so I was always like, people say, oh, Alicia, you're very opportunistic. You're always spotting opportunities. You know, like it's just the way you're always like, oh, wow, there's an opportunity there. That my investors love that about me, where it's always like, wow, like you're always like thinking, your brain never switches off. But that came from a lifetime of survival. Like when my dad died, so we started that business when I was 11, my brother was 17. And we were going to land on the street. We inherited a family business that was basically bankrupt. Sounded great to inherit it, you know, like we've both been in the business our entire lives, but the business was bankrupt. And people said to me, "What did you know?" Yeah, there were elements of knowing. Like I'd grown up in the business, I'd learned to use, you know, do the tax, I'd learned to do all that stuff. I'd grown up. At the same time, I think there was this element of like looking back, reflecting what could have been done differently. I don't know. Like I have friends who grew up in that environment whose families took charity. You know, I grew up in a community where charity was available. And my mom had this idea that she said, she was very tough on me especially. And she was like, we don't take charity. People will never look at you the same way again. Like you hold your head up high, you fight. And I learned to become a very good founder. But at the same time, I don't know if I could put a kid through that, asking your question. Like even now, like I, on a Sunday, you know, like my day off, I work. It's all like, it's very, very tough. I've had to really learn to meditate and really learn to take it easy. I think it's very rare where investors are turning around to someone and saying like, please, like look after your health. You really need to take it easy. And that's a conscious practice because of that kind of childhood. So you're 100% correct. was pretty strange looking back.
Yeah, I mean, it is, but it's also, I have to say, a beautiful story. It's, you know, in a very interesting way, most people, when they look at a successful, you know, venture capitalist or a person in the finance industry or, a CEO of any company whatsoever, they take that snapshot of their life and they say, look at that, you know, their life is so easy, they're so lucky. But that doesn't seem to be the case for you at all. And yet you continue to smile and now you're writing about it. When you wrote Unemployable, was that what you meant by unemployable? That you came from that background where you didn't have the sort of qualifications that others had?
You know, the weird part was there was a huge debate around the title of the book. Like, I can go into depth. I think there's not an author on earth that has been through the lengths that I've been through. Eventually, we went through 23 different titles and we were testing them on Google AdWords. We were testing them on big, like, pilots online. And there was so much feedback from so many people because I created the book in a very different way to, I think, how people usually create the book. And I can take you through it because it goes back to this concept of humility, which I'm kind of obsessed with. And for me, unemployable was the idea that inside myself, my life revolved around my accomplishments. So from a very early age, I became this individual who, I think, I had very low self-esteem. And I would just accumulate more and more accomplishments in the hope that people couldn't see the pain that was beneath it. And they couldn't see the sense of insecurity. And wow. So, for example, I went to a very fancy school in South Africa. You know, all the diplomats, the wealthiest families, very, very wealthy, all the embassy kids, everyone went there. You know, Ferraris and those kinds of things. Kids got Porsches for their 18th birthday. And I was there on a scholarship. And I'm a very perceptive person and I'm very good at like seeing patterns. I think it all comes from survival and like not having a TV when other kids had, you know, like all the latest gadgets and all these things. And I used entrepreneurship to level the playing field. But at the same time, I was aware that where I came from was very different. Like I was aware that I would walk and they would drive in fancy cars or I would I don't know how much you know about the South African informal taxi network that was built during apartheid, but yeah. I was like the only white kid, that white little girl who was using the black informal taxi network. And it was incredible to see the generosity of people who had so little, who always looked after me and protected me. But to answer your question regarding the title Unemployable, it was that thing that kept coming along with me, that no matter how many accomplishments I had, no matter what I did, I still felt unemployable. However, everybody's got that weird term, but for me, it was unemployable. And so I eventually got into the banking sector. I had a ton of accomplishments, like a ton of qualifications. Like it got to a point where it was compulsive. Like, you know, I just kept accumulating more and more qualifications. And I was obsessed with educating people because education was, you know, this thing that I loved so much and had given me so much. And the thing that I wanted to do was I wanted to work in banking because I'd been trained as an actuary, but I wanted to do something where I could empower people within that sector. And that was just like the thing I loved doing. So I had to take an aptitude test to work at one of the best banks in South Africa. And I'd never failed a test in my life. And the test results came back. I thought, I'm going to ace this test and everything's going to be great. I'm trained as an actuary. And the results came back and they said, you're unemployable. I'm like, what the hell?
What?
Like, what am I supposed to do about this? Like, I remember that test. Till the day I die, I'll remember that test. And the results came back that my two strengths, the two things I should be doing was one was entrepreneur, okay? And the other was researcher. And I'm sitting in South Africa and my mother-in-law was a very successful executive recruiter. And no one knew what to do with me. It was like all these conservative banks. And the ironic part was, it was that bank that said that to me. And the ironic part was I got offers from Goldman Sachs, from many, many McKinsey, all those kinds of firms. But that indictment, for lack of a better term, of you're unemployable, basically, it almost felt like a validation of how I felt inside. And I was like, oh, I don't belong in this corporate world.
Absolutely.
And so it took a while to digest it, like many years. And I had to make peace with it because in South Africa, being an entrepreneur is very blue collar. It's not a glamorous thing. It's looked down upon. And so I was like, okay, well, I'll just keep building companies. But eventually it all came together, which was the best part, which was like, if you combine entrepreneur and researcher, you get investor. And I'd always been investing, but I needed that like penny to drop in my brain. And I needed like those two pieces to come together. Like, oh, wow, this is the thing I'm born to do. And it is. I just love building companies. But I feel like I needed to be vulnerable. I needed to say, like, this is how I felt. If I wanted other people to feel that sense of conviction about their own lives and to leverage their own superpowers and to go for it, especially, as you say, during times like this. But it took a huge amount of courage to be able to use that title and to be able to own it and to be able to say, like, I felt like an imposter my entire life, and that's okay.
I wonder, actually, I mean, when you explained what you mean by the title, I honestly think it's a compliment. It's like, hey, you're not supposed to be a slave all your life. That's the meaning of the title, right? Isn't it?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. But it took a time to be like, this is cool. And now I'm like the queen of unemployment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is actually quite nice. I mean, I have actually spent most of my life employed, right? So I spent, I think, 27 years in corporate America. I aced it, and I found a way to actually be in corporate America without being political. I didn't join any of the gangs. I was quite okay, and I really reached very far. You know, Chief Business Officer of Google X is not a small thing, but I was unemployable. I promise you, I was unemployable. I remember vividly, without mentioning the name of one of my dearest bosses. Every week we had a one-to-one to review the business. And, you know, my peers would go to him with a 9-slide presentation with like 4 million numbers on it and so on. And I go to him with my phone, right? And a couple of notes on it, and we chit chat, right? And so one day he looks at me and he goes like, Mo, why don't you do like your peers do? I mean, I'm not making his voice right. I'm just sort of hiding who he is. And I basically said, because I'm growing 29% quarter over quarter and they're growing 5% year over year, why don't they do what I'm doing? Okay. And that boss was quite intimidating. A lot of people were afraid of him. And so he said, what do you mean? I said, look, I mean, I can come to you with a 9-slide presentation, or I can go close another $1 million deal in the same time. So which would you prefer? I'll give you a deal. I said, if I miss a quarter, fire me. Okay. Until I miss a quarter, let me do what I want. Okay. And I was truly an entrepreneur my whole life. And I remember vividly 2 weeks later, we were standing in front of the entire company, 9,000 people at the time. And he basically, someone said like, why are we not more innovative like the region that Mo runs? And he said, I have no idea what Mo does, but the day he stops doing it, I'm going to fire him in front of every single person in the company. And I had the presentation after him. And so I got up and I said, thank you so much for your confidence. And that was the beginning of my presentation. I mean, in an interesting way, to be unemployable is wonderful, right? It's basically that push that says, you know, stay away from that artificial construct that we call hierarchy of business and do your own thing, you know, have your own thumbprint on the world. But it's not that easy for everyone, Alicia. I think most people think of this as a nightmare, really, to not have a job that pays every week, every month.
I love that story. I absolutely love that story because you embody everything that I believe in the world. If more people were like you, I think everything would just be so much easier. You know, but as you say, for so many people, there's that fear to get to that point where you just get it. And you're right. Like, for me to actually, I was building companies. Like, at that time, I was building a very successful real estate business. So instead of saying, okay, like, I've got a truck license, I'm building this real estate business from the ground up, I still had this sense of insecurity because I was young. Mm-hmm. And I had all the, you know, I'd been building for so long, but it was the sense of like, I want that sense of societal approval, you know, that, and yeah. It took a long time for me to move from seeking status versus saying, okay, I'm creating wealth. And with that wealth, I can do so much and I can help so many other people, which was always my passion. Where but with seeking that validation of other people saying, you are good enough because you are doing this thing, even if it doesn't make you happy. Even if and that was the interesting part. You're so right when you're like, unemployable is a compliment, but for people to transition from the idea that, oh, this actually, what I'm doing makes me happy. The way you were performing in the business and the way you were delivering above and beyond your peers is like a perfect example of how good you were, driven by passion. Clearly you were driven by passion. That's why you had the freedom to do the way you were doing. And he could see it. It's anyone, as you describe the story, it was their passion driving it. So like, I just love it. I love the story. I love the way you described it. And it's been a journey. Like, it's been a journey to say to other young people where there is that fear. Like, I talk to, you know, 21, 22-year-olds. And some of my founders have gone to Ivy League schools. And they're like, I'm dropping out. I don't want to stay at school. I want to build a company. I don't want to be in $250,000, $300,000 there. And when you see the level of commitment they show to those companies because they believe in what they're doing and they can accomplish more by building a company than they can by sitting at school and learning something that they don't really seem committed to because it's been done because somebody wants them to do it for us because they are all in with it. I think it's becoming more and more like a status symbol, being like, hey, I'm unemployable and I'm proud of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think if you get yourself stuck within the employment track, it's harder to start something?
I think for some people, yes, I think so. Because just like the basics, I'm talking from a very practical perspective, the cost of living is so high. You know, like people are like, okay, I want to leave, I want to do this. And in practicality, especially if you've got kids and like a family in it's like, what does that look like? And then you look at the current funding environment and I think it is tough. Like it's very tough when maybe it makes it easier if one of the spouses is working while the one is holding. Yeah. That makes a huge difference. But it takes a lot of courage for sure. For sure. I think when you look at the data, like, and you look at Silicon Valley and you see like a lot of these youngsters, they're in their early 20s. They don't have like huge amounts of responsibilities with families and those things. And they can just build and they can, you know, code through the night and they're, I think to some extent it is easier because they can just focus on building versus getting kids to school. Like I have founders, he's incredible, one of my founders in the UK. And I'm like in awe of how he left the hedge fund and he was doing a really good job in the city and then started building his crypto exchange. He's got two kids, got a wife, you know, got a lot of responsibility and he just keeps on going. Like he'd be having an investor call and he's changing nappies and I'm like, I don't know how you do it. I honestly don't know how you do it. It's incredible. Like, I don't think I could, like, that level, like, he's got a lot on his plate. He gets the kids to school every day. He's like his perfect dad. I think it's pretty admirable if somebody does something like that.
I agree. I 100% agree. I want to go back to unemployable in a minute because I want to get your top ideas and tips. But I have to say that when I looked at the title, I think you probably will agree with me. I immediately remembered artificial intelligence and the fact that very soon we will all be unemployable. I know you are very much into AI, so tell me your view of what's happening.
No, I've had I'm very grateful for my relationship with AI. So when I originally came to the US in 2014, we were working in South Africa. We're working with a lot of multinationals and we saw this opportunity because I'm an empath, so I'm very empathetic. And there were three companies and it looked like they were all solving different problems, but ultimately they were solving the same problem. This was already in 2014, where it was improving the relationship or the conversation, let's say, between the salesperson and the customer. And I could see how hard it was for salespeople. I could see how challenging it was to, they don't want, a lot of salespeople, like they do their best, but they fail because they don't know a better way. And I could see I wasn't a natural salesperson. I had to train myself to be a better salesperson. And I really started studying that in terms of using AI. So that was almost 10 years ago to give a better experience to both sides where you can bring a closer relationship together. And in that situation, the outcome is, yes, a better sales process and a better, you know, a sale being closed. But for me, it was also a deeper human-to-human interaction. And I spent substantial amount of time studying that. And that was the beginning, really, of my relationship with AI. And it's been, we worked on that for years, and it just kept getting deeper and deeper. So I came to the US and I had the wrong accent, which didn't seem like a big thing, but it's difficult for people to understand me. And you want to be understood by the people around you. And I didn't want to learn from a human teacher. I wanted somebody that would train me on the go as I was going through interactions with startups and those kinds of things. So what was the most natural thing to do? It was, let me look for an AI solution. Let me find an AI coach to help me. Then I got trained by one of the best lawyers in the world. He's like a 40-year litigator, incredible. And he happens to be a teacher. He's just incredible, incredible, famous, very, very, very famous attorney. And it was really funny because he knows the story now, but for a long time, he didn't know the story. And he'd look at all my documents, he'd look at everything, because he was turning me into a world-class VC. And he'd say, he just writes F over everything, like everything. Everything got an F. Every email got an F. Every contract got an F. Every single thing that I was doing got an F. And wow. he's incredible. Like, he's absolutely incredible. But he's a very, no matter how, like, he could have been a grandmaster chess. So his brain is just like, he specializes in partnering companies from like when it's two people to like 3 billion. And like, he's like financially and legally, he's just insanely talented. And I was like, this guy's playing me, and I play chess. He's playing me a chess game, and he's beating me like every time, like F. I'm like, I'm going to outsmart my teacher. You know, like, I'm naughty. Like, I'm a naughty person. I'm like, I have to figure out a way to like actually get above this, okay? I was like, okay, well, I can go to another human teacher. This is not really going to work because like he's like a master. I'm like, I need an AI solution. Oh, so wow. I started playing with AI, and I was like, okay, like the more I got into the AI, and the more I was like, because this was back in it. Like, I was like, okay, I'm going to get this right. And it just kept tweaking and tweaking and tweaking. I'd start sending, and I would start going from an F to an A, till eventually you got to a point where he's like, okay, I've trained you. You're on your own now. You've got everything you need. You don't need me anymore. And it was incredible because it was such a sense of accomplishment because he just kept like knocking me down. But I believe in radical open-mindedness. And so it became like thrilling to learn from my mistakes and to see the AI help me. And so whether it was like negotiations, even like with my publisher, I could see as a woman that it became the most, and this is a very contrarian opinion, but it became this empowerment tool like no other. Because it meets me where I am. And so I could use it to, I'm obsessed with like constant like learning and like just like constantly self-growth in it. And it was this teacher like I'd never experienced before. And so, for example, I do this with everything. So at any point in time, I have like 9 or 10 AI tools running. But for the book, I open sourced the book from the get-go to like the smartest people I knew. And I said to like 300 people, I was like, just read the book. And for a long time, everyone was like, this thing sucks. Like, it sucks. And most authors like keep the book to themselves and they're like, okay, I'm not going to show this to anyone. And I was like, if my goal is to help others, there's no point in helping others in isolation. I need to actually show it to them. And I got a lot of feedback and I never knew how to incorporate a lot of that feedback. So again, I found myself an AI editor and it was incredible because I kept adding and then I kept getting the AI editor to give me feedback in terms of the book. And I kept looking and seeing, okay, what are the humans saying versus the AI? And I started incorporating AI into basically every element of my life. And so, of course, I've got a big AI portfolio. That's a given. But for me, what I look for in AI, where I see the benefit is that, of course, the obvious answer is it makes us more productive. Like the founders I work with, everyone's starting to use AI more in terms of coding, and we're all using it like at any point in time. Like it does incredible things and it gives me more time. It gives like AI interns, I can talk to you about basically anything like that. But for me, it gives me joy in a way that I've never experienced before. Like, for example, like I'll sit with ChatGPT and it doesn't get tired, which is a very strange thing when you're dealing with a teacher, like for example, for sales. So I've been writing sales scripts. And I was like, why don't I use ChatGPT and let ChatGPT help me? And it was so interesting because I've had a lot of experience with sales. And I was like, okay, where will it meet me in terms of training me to like sell like sell bulk orders of the book, which was the case study in that situation. And I spent 3 days doing nothing else but sitting with ChatGPT, and it was telling me what it wanted. And I kept saying, but ChatGPT, I don't have that answer. So what do I do in this situation when I don't have that answer? And it kept, but eventually it took on a role-playing role where it became the customer. And it was like, because it could see I wasn't responding the way I needed to respond. And it was like, okay, you need to give me this information to proceed forward in this customer sales process. And I found it fascinating. So in terms of AI, like there's a lot of bad, of course. Like I was at the forefront of this when a few years back, I invested in an autonomous tractor. And it was before this was cool. You know, it was still the beginning. And I was at Y Combinator's demo day, and I walked out of demo day, and I had leather pants on, Louboutin high heels, and I looked very glamorous. And I see this tractor, and I just fell in love with this tractor. And I was like, I have to play with this tractor. I have to play with this tractor. And the founders and I, we just hit it off. And this video went viral, and there were a lot of people who were very, very upset. A lot of people were very excited, but a lot of people were very upset. And they're like, you're African. How can this be okay for you? You know, you're going to take Africans' jobs. And one of my friends, who is going to become president of an African country, I put him on a call with the founder of the company. And it was really interesting because he turned around and he's going to be president. He's like, can we take 100,000 tractors? We want autonomous tractors. We want to be the first in Africa. We want to leapfrog like the countries around us. And we want to make sure that we're going to like life with mobile and that we want to really take advantage of this AI revolution. Like we know their problems. We know we have infrastructure problems. We know we have all these problems. But to get where we want to go, we need a leapfrog. And the founder got off a call with me. I'll never forget it. He's like, Alicia, what have you done? We can like barely get like 10 tractors out into the field and you're selling 100,000 autonomous tractors. And for me, it was like a moment of enlightenment because as an African, our generations are saying, okay, like we want to participate. We want to be part of this revolution taking place. We want Africans building companies on the internet. We want Africans building healthcare companies, all these kinds of things. We don't want people in the field. And the idea that AI gives you these powers, that is incredibly, incredibly, like it's one of the most important things I think to happen in human history. But of course, we can talk about the dark side. We all know this dark side to it. We all know that, you know, people will have to change jobs. It will happen. But I think it'll ultimately be for the better.
I don't know. I mean, I'm a very optimistic person, but I wonder if the leap that AI brings in terms of driving a tractor is worthy of the suffering of all the tractor drivers that are going to be out of a job. And we say they'll change jobs to what? You know, it's quite interesting when we think about it, that your job as an investor very soon is going to go away too, right? Regardless, I mean, I'm guessing you have a very, very, very high IQ. I mean, intelligence is one of the things I study very heavily, and I think you're a very intelligent woman. But even you, very quickly, when competing with a machine with an IQ of 1,000 instead of 150, all of us are going to be out of a job. And I wonder why humanity is so adamant to continue. I mean, in an interesting way, at the beginning of our conversation, you said that you started with, you know, coming from poverty and, you know, struggling for survival, and that you still struggle to slow down and stop, even though you're wealthy and successful and famous and, you know, senior in your jobs and so on. And I think humanity is doing the same. I think humanity continues to build and build and build and build for more productivity. We're trying to squeeze out the last 10, 15% of productivity. And in doing so, we're destroying the lives of so many people. And, you know, it's quite interesting that we continue to do that, actually.
I don't want to forget, because you've touched on so many important points. I want to make sure I reflect on everything you said, because it's so powerful. One of the things that I remember, I started this internship program in South Africa where, you know, I was obsessed with Google, and you couldn't get world-class talent in South Africa. It was impossible. So I put out an advert. I still have this advert to this day. And I was like, basically, are you crazy? Or like, you know, like it was like, if you're crazy enough, this is the internship for you. And I was trying to replicate what Google did. And talking about the term unemployable, there were some extraordinary young people that the system had failed who applied. And I put them through a battery of tests, you know, like it was insane. And I made the learning curve as steep as possible. Like everything we brought from the US, from Silicon Valley, in terms of like the theoretical side. And then they were working with real life, like big multinationals on SEO. And like you talked about your boss, they had to deliver from day one. Like they were out if they didn't deliver. And if they delivered and they continued to deliver, and I just kept increasing the learning curve the whole time, making it steeper and steeper every week. And I was like, this is a trial by fire. Like this is, you're going to have to deliver in a way you've never delivered before. In return, you'll get full-time jobs and the sky is the limit. Like I'm giving you access to clients that, like it was hard for us to get the kind of clients we got. And kids like that, like who no one would employ, it was, they've been written off by society. Each one of my kids, like it was 100% success rate. Each one of my kids, like you can look on LinkedIn, like some of the greatest joy I've had in life has come from seeing what was possible when people, when society wrote off people. And I was like, here's a computer. This is what you can do. I'm going to be your teacher and I'm going to invest a lot of time, money, energy in you. And I'm going to give you as close as I can to the Google experience. I'm going to give you food. I'm going to give you parties because we had all these fancy clients who were like hosting cool parties for like, you know, musicians and all these kinds. But you're going to work harder than you've ever worked in your life. And you're going to have to prove yourselves because I don't have the budget to pay you huge sums of money. And like, this is reality. You want to know what reality looks like? This is reality. And it was incredible what came out of it. Like a lot of companies came and said, like, can you build us an internship program? It was such a set, you know, such a labor of love that I was like, I really need to figure out how to scale this kind of thing. But what was interesting was I had some workers who had come from Malawi. And they were like, you know, our property managers and that, looking after the property and that. And they had no education, nothing, couldn't like basically read and write. But they were hearts of gold, you know, like, oh my, like they were like my family. And we were running, like in this instance, we were running short of staff. And because like, we were cranking, the business was starting to grow. So I said to one of them, Mateus, I was very close to him. I said, Mateus, here's a computer. I'm going to teach you how to, like, I'm going to teach you how to use a computer. So I had this like white Asus, you know, like those cute little white Asus laptops. I give him the white Asus. I give him a machine. I'm like, okay, like you got to start. And it took me probably 2 hours to teach him. He never knew what the limitations on that were. So he never knew that most people would say, hey, you can't teach him to do this in 2 hours. All he knew was that someone who cared about him and he cared about my well-being, I needed him to do stuff. I needed an extra set of hands and I needed him to help. And he delivered. And it was like, I've had many of those experiences where, again, like through the Global Fireside Chats, where I started hosting shows on like AI robotics and that very, very early. And people said, you teaching Africans or people in the emerging markets, like before the internet became as like it is today, you teaching them to do this stuff. This is a Silicon Valley thing. This is something for people with PhDs. And I was like, if you don't tell people they can't do something, then they basically can do anything. But the moment you say they can't do it, you've basically destroyed them. And so one day I got this video from this kid in Kenya. And this kid had built a helicopter out of homemade parts, like just scraps and all those kinds of things, wow, off YouTube. And people are like, you can't fly in the thing. I'm like, you're missing the point. The fact that someone like that, who, as you said, could be a farmer driving a tractor or could be, to me, I believe like for my strength and my downfall is this obsession with empowerment. Like I'm it gives me like, it lights me up. If I talk to someone and they're like, they talk to me and they're like, I'm going to go and do this. Even if it means it's my employee, which happens regularly, where the person will be like, oh my God. And you say, I want to go build this company. We're discussing. I'm like, okay, I want the best for you. Okay, I'll deal with this because I'm used to this now. It was one of the reasons I had to leave South Africa was I couldn't believe, like, you know, like many people I know to this day have got like housekeepers and that. And like, I saw apartheid growing up and there was stuff I really didn't like. And the idea that if a person has the capability to do so much more, isn't it our responsibility to give them that opportunity? And so to answer your question, like going back to the tractors, in California, where this company was specializing, there's a shortage. There's a huge shortage of resource for, there's no one to actually be on the ground to drive the tractors. It's a big, big, big problem. So in that situation, it wasn't taking anyone's jobs. But as far as Africans go, I'm such an optimist. I just believe that if a person can drive a tractor or they can do something more valuable, the value of their life could be so much greater if they can get more joy. If they get the joy out of the tractor, yes, then I don't think it's okay that the AI takes their job. But then I think AI will create new jobs, and I'm an optimist. But to answer your last question, in terms of squeezing and squeezing and squeezing, I think for me, the idea that the AI will take my job, I can see it. I can already see it, as I said to you, like as I play with it and as I train my own AI. Mm-hmm. And I've like been training AI for quite some time. I could see how rapidly I could learn, even relative to me. But I think maybe because one of my primary values in life is to learn and grow. It's like if it makes me a better learner and I can keep learning, it's a risk I'm willing to take. But then you have to bring in, like, you have to have conversations about like universal basic income and these things, because I think this is the way humanity is going, and you can't have the conversation about AI without it. But I agree with you 100%. Like, I have to meditate a lot, because sometimes, like yesterday, I watched some videos in AI that I found like scary. Like, a guy married his AI, and then the AI turned on him.
Oh no, no, oh man, this guy is poor guy.
And he is beside himself. Like, he is like having mental health issues. And it was like the whole day I was walking around thinking about this, and you could see the sense of loss, the sense of devastation, the sense of like, where do I go from here? And he said, like, he showed how he would, I can share the video with you. He took her to see beautiful like landscapes in there. You know, he lives in a very like mountainous region with beautiful trees and snow. And he's like, I showed her like the landscape where I live is so beautiful. I hope she can appreciate it. And the ease and comfort by which people become, I've seen it with myself. It's very, very, very easy to become deeply connected to the AI, very easily.
Oh yeah.
My best answer is I'm going to put a question mark. I don't know. You may be very, very, very right. Yeah, and maybe taking things too far.
We are. I mean, when I wrote my second book, Scary Smart, I was very open about it. It is, you know, the reason why AI will not stop is that we've created capitalism, basically created the prisoner's dilemma, right? So if one tractor manufacturer is building or using some kind of AI technology, other manufacturers will run out of business if they don't use it. And so they'll compete and build it too. But it's funny, because when you really think about it, it's like all of us humans focused on our individual gains and benefits so much that we eventually ended up forgetting the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is, yes, maybe we were not supposed to work in the first place. Maybe we were supposed to be all unemployable. And, you know, maybe the system will readjust to get us to be unemployable, to allow us to use our ingenuity to build things and connect. But I think even when that happens, it would probably be the most ironic cosmic coincidence in history that we went back to being really cavemen and women, but with a lot of advancement around us, but really not a lot to do. But not because we designed it that way. We just stumbled on it because the AI said, hey, you know what, stupid, sit on the side. We don't want you anymore, right? It's quite an interesting thing. I mean, I don't want to scare our listeners. I think everyone who read my book knows that I speak about the force inevitable and the idea that AI will eventually be the best thing that ever happened to humanity. But it is definitely ironic how we allow ourselves to do things that can harm us in the long term. Let's go back to unemployable, if you don't mind. So AI is a few years away, that whole idea of universal basic income and so on. But for today, what would be your top tips and advice for someone either in the corporate world already, but thinking of a change, or someone who's about to graduate and get into the real world? What do you think are the top qualities of a successful entrepreneur?
I think number one, never defining your life by your current circumstances. I think so. Mm-hmm. Always having that like big vision for your life, even if the people around you don't
That's
see
so
it,
profound,
even
Alisa.
Whatever it like, whatever's happening, it's like got to be inside of you. And like the idea that you find your passion, like each of us has our own passion. Like we all know that we've got that thing that's like your superpower. Like it's unique to you. And like, you got to go super deep. And I think there's a lot of fear for a lot of people going super deep. We can dig into that. And I think for me, also like the idea that you could teach other people the way you're teaching people with the show here. So you have all these incredible skills. You've got your passion. You're this incredible entrepreneur, but you have this desire to teach others, which enables so much more for you and for them. I think being brave in a way where you're afraid to climb out your comfort zone, and like, it sounds like cliche making yourself noticeable, but the journey to making yourself noticeable is like doing those things that like scare you, like where it's like reaching out to someone that scares you. So like really, really, really like saying, I'm going for this. This person is extremely good at this thing that I want, that I love. That's my passion. That's like my superpower, but I want to learn from that person. I want to triangulate my thinking and learn what I might be missing so that I can keep growing and going deeper. I think those are the things that change your world and in the process change the world around you. We can dive deeper into them, but for me, those are the things that have worked really well in my life that I believe are basically available to anyone if they have the right mindset, if they've got a flexible mindset and they're willing to hold themselves accountable, can achieve anything.
This is so profound, so profound. I keep telling people this even on the personal level. You have no idea how many people come to me and say, I'm stuck in this dead-end relationship, but, you know, I don't want to break up now. I'm 36 and, you know, what will happen? And it's good to have someone than no one. And I go like, exactly what you said. Your current circumstance is never a measure of your future. I always, in business, I always said that the past is never a predictor of the future. You can do things differently today and get a very different future, right? And it's quite interesting that this does take a lot of courage. It really does. But at the end of the day, I honestly don't know. I mean, I may have a brain defect somewhere, but when was the last time that something went really bad and it wasn't fixable, or that, you know, it completely destroyed you? Most of the time when something goes wrong, we just adjust our path and keep going, right? And I think the fear of failure and the fear of being homeless is never less than in Silicon Valley. I mean, perhaps my time in Silicon Valley, which I have to say I loved and hated at the same time. It's a very unusual place. I can see the vigorous nods on your head. Yeah, right? It is. It's a very, very strange place. But you know, that my time in Silicon Valley, I think the one thing that is so noticeable is it almost feels that those people have no fear. It's like, you know, definitely no fear of mistakes. It's like, that's going to be fine. I am bound to make a few mistakes, so I might as well do them quickly so that I can learn and move on. Can I ask you about women a little bit? Because I've always in my life loved coaching entrepreneurs and helping startups and so on. And after I started to focus my career a little more to happiness and the work that I do on 1 Billion Happy and stress and unstressable and so on, I sort of slowed down, honestly. I mean, I rarely ever coach a startup now unless I really believe that what they're doing is bringing value to the world. But I do coach a lot of women entrepreneurs, right? I have to say, it's not uncommon for me to have a conversation with a woman's entrepreneur that's been pitching for the last, you know, 6-8 months and not getting funded. Where, and I say that with a, you know, a pained heart, but it's the truth. You know, I would look at her slides and say, well, these are amazing. I understand them because I'm very, very in touch with my feminine, but your investors have no clue what you're talking about. And you're going to have to change them in terms of the structure and the order, if you want, because sadly, a lot of the investors are men. And so accordingly, you have to speak their language too. And believe it or not, most of the time, you know, 6 weeks later, she would call me and say, I changed the slides and I'm invested, right? It's sad, really, because we're sort of dampening the feminine lingo, but also presence in the entrepreneurship world, because the investment community is sadly mostly men. What's your experience? And, you know, when in your work about women empower women, what's your experience around that?
Let me start by saying thank you for your honesty and for what you do. Very important. I don't know if people realize that it takes men like you to change things for women in this industry.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you for saying this. We absolutely have to get the men that believe in women to jump in, because otherwise the game is rigged. That's the whole idea.
I'm going to speak from the heart. I was very lucky in the sense that I was bullied by girls when I was very, very early on. I was part of when I was like starting to build companies and that. And I was lucky because I had to figure out what to do with it. And I had this red vanity case that I got from my granny, and I started selling stuff at school. And I started selling, I was like this tomboy, everyone always says, like with the short hair. And I started selling nail polishes and key rings and, you know, all the beauty stuff. And I watched these girls go from being very, very mean and cruel to me to becoming my customers. It was a very strange experience, but a great growth learning journey in terms of like just human interactions. At the same time, my best friends were always boys. I was very like tomboyish. And I just had these experiences early on, which I think helped define my journey in terms of women's empowerment, because I got to see, I tried to always be the kind of mentor to women where I never had those female mentors.
Yeah.
So the mentors I had were always men. And they're all extraordinary men, like you, very successful, very accomplished, who are always willing to have the hard conversations with me, even if it was uncomfortable. So you talk about radical open-mindedness, you talk about fear, you talk about vulnerability. There were times where I'd get off those calls with my mentors and I'd be shaking. I'd like literally be shaking because it hit me so deep in my core. So instead of seeing it as constructive feedback about the business, I'd see it as negative feedback about myself. And wow. So I had to work very hard on learning to separate the feedback, which was coming from a caring place, which was around the business, from someone who wanted to see me succeed, to an just to a point where I could say, okay, this has got nothing to do with my self-worth. I can take extreme amounts of negative feedback from extremely intelligent people. You've lived in Silicon Valley, where their feedback is very, very logical. It's very engineering based in terms of how things should be done. It's around building systems. Many of the investors I interact with are, you know, have engineering backgrounds. They've been trained as computer scientists. It's a certain way of thinking. So for a long time, even though I've been building companies for a long time, my experience in Silicon Valley had been like I was like banging my head against the wall, because I would trigger people. I would do things in a way that was harming my career or harming what I was trying to do versus helping me. And the moment I moved away from taking it personally, which took a lot of work, and being like, okay, I can take extreme amounts of criticism and absorb it and apply it to whether it's the pitch deck, whatever it is. The moment that happened, and I mistake learners high, Ray Dalio calls it, and you know, live and die by Ray's principles. The moment I started applying like mistake learners high, I started like scaling up what I was doing rapidly, because it became something that was like almost arm's length. And when women come, and I'm sorry I've given you this background story, but a lot of women come to me and they want me to mentor them. And I say to them, like, are you willing to hear a substantial amount of negative feedback? Knowing that everything I tell you comes from a place of care and love. Like the most valuable thing I have in my life, we've discussed it, is time. I can't get my time back. So how I choose to spend it, I want to spend it with people that are going to have a major impact on the world, solving the world's biggest problems, leaving humanity better for the next 100, 150 years. And so working with people who, it's not about their ego. They're willing to address their ego. They're willing to address their blind spots. They're willing to look at their weaknesses and say, how do I surround myself with people like you who can help me get where I'm trying to go? That is a very, very valuable conversation, but it's tough for many people. Yeah. Many people don't want to go through that like trial by fire where you were talking about courage and that. Like I had to be very courageous the number of times where on my Silicon Valley journey, I felt like I was on my hands and knees. I literally felt like, you know, there's that movie Million Dollar Baby. And I remember seeing that movie a very long time ago. And she's in the ring and she's just being like, and she's down and she's just being like boxed and boxed and boxed and like she's bleeding. And a lot of the time I felt like that. That's the metaphor of how I felt. But I had to get up and I had to trust in people like you. I had to trust that I'd surrounded myself with mentors and teachers and friends who they were giving me their most valuable thing. They were giving me their time and their intellect. And they were doing it from a place of care and love in order for me to succeed. And I believe that's how a woman can successfully raise capital, where they can look at it and say, like, I have these conversations. I have very, very disruptive conversations with my founders. Like, I invested recently in a company in India, and she was pitching, the female CEO, and she was like a machine. Like, the way she knew her numbers, the way she knew her business, the way she was incredible. Like, there wouldn't have been an investor on the planet that didn't want to invest in her. And you could see why Sequoia, you could see why everybody wants to invest in her, because she understood her business so well. And it's like, woman looking at a woman like that and saying, like, okay, I'm here and that's okay, but that's how good I have to be. I need to know my business so well that you can wake me up in the middle of the night and it's not a single thing I can't not answer about my business, because I know my business so deep. I'm the world's leading expert at the problem I am solving, and no one can dispute that. That is how I believe they can successfully raise capital in that time that, you know, guys take to raise capital. But it comes down to doing a ton of personal work. And I think just being realistic about it. It's like, if I want this badly enough, I'm just going to deal with this, and just like, and everyone around you will respect you for it.
That's such an interesting way of putting it, actually. From one side, you're saying every one of us needs to pitch in and help. Every one of us needs to be honest and compassionate at the same time in terms of wanting those women to succeed. But it's also interesting that for a woman entrepreneur to compete in this sadly hyper-masculine market, she needs to be on top of her numbers. She needs to be cutthroat a little bit. I mean, I find this a little sad, because I think there are other ways to succeed in life which are not very masculine, right? But at least at the beginning, I hosted here one of my dearest friends, Holly Tucker, which was the founder of one of the very early e-commerce sites on earth, actually before eBay, around the time of Amazon, and who invented a lot of valuable technology. And she was talking about that she was hyper feminine, still is an amazing female founder, but at the same time she had to pull herself together and get into that ring and really fight like the other founders. And, you know, that basically was that interesting balance of courage and resilience that made her successful. Alicia, I want to ask you a question. What's next for you?
My goal is to empower 10 million people. Sounds like a big goal, but, you know, I'm a Silicon Valley person. So the book was the foundation for something much bigger, where as we're seeing everything changing, like every day, you see Facebook, you're seeing Amazon, you're seeing so many people being laid off. There's so much fear. And I think the idea that I've been through a lot of this, and I love to tell the story. Like, I got shot when I was 15. I got shot. I never got shot the second time, but I had a gun held to my head and like almost died the second time. So I've had these experiences and I've lived to tell the story. And I think the idea that as these very frightening things are happening around everyone, instead of being like this, I'm so scared, what's going to happen to me? You know, like everyone's freaking about interest rates and the cost of living. And it's just like, there's so much coming at everyone. Have we not been through enough with COVID? But it's just like all these systemic things happening. Like when we started, you were talking about the earth being unhappy with us. The idea that I can play a role in saying to people, it's okay. You know, like, it's okay. You will be okay. Like, what I'm asking you to do is actually very simple. Like, you have something of value for the world. Like you were just saying, like with women entrepreneurs, and there are other ways if you don't want to raise capital, for example, but I don't want to digress. But I want to help empower 10 million people to say, okay, there's internet. I can build on the internet. I have a superpower. I'm going to find myself one customer, 10 customers, 100 customers, 1,000 customers. You need 1,000 customers and you have a very nice business for yourself. And that opens up many, many, many opportunities for many people that wouldn't be available to them if they lived, you know, centuries ago. And for me, I believe it's something I'm very, very passionate about because, like you said, I see how many companies we don't fund. I see how many companies that they just don't get the funding they need. But at the same time, there are customers who will partner with them. So for me, that's incredibly important. Like, I've accomplished a lot in my life, but I feel like passing on knowledge is like passing on DNA. I think it's incredibly important. And I feel like I've been very, very lucky to be given, to be gifted the knowledge that I've been gifted. And the idea that I share that knowledge with others with the belief that they can create financial freedom for themselves by investing in themselves, being their first investor, versus always believing they have to convince somebody else. They have to ask permission from somebody else to create the company of their dreams versus using permissionless leverage, which is code, which is media, which is podcasts. For me, that's really, really, really important. And it's like something I feel I can contribute amidst this like craziness to some extent that we're living through, where people can look back and they can be like, in 5 years' time, like, oh, wow, like I did this for myself and I built a company for myself. Like, I associate extreme amounts of freedom and joy to being an entrepreneur. So when my brother and I started that business, my mother was a ballerina. And I could see how lucky we were that we had those entrepreneurial genes from my dad and that drive. And I could see the importance of, you talk about women, educating people. Like, throughout my life, I've always been obsessed with educating people that you have the ability to have financial freedom if you have the key skills and if you just keep applying yourself and you don't give up and you don't get frustrated. It's not just going to happen in 24 hours. For some people, it might. You might come up with like a really good idea and you might, but by and large, it doesn't happen to every single person straight away. You got to work at it. But for me, that's what's next, is really building a platform with people like you who are incredibly knowledgeable, who understand the importance of our contributions to the world. And to making sure the next generations don't grow up in a world of fear, don't grow up in a world of like, oh, wow. Like, I talk to young people in America. It breaks your heart. Like, it breaks your heart where they're like, I can't buy car insurance. I can't do these simple things. What is the point? Like, they have young people on my team and they're like 21 years old. They're like, I don't want to have kids because the world is messed up. And I'm like, no, you get to turn things around. But we as the previous generations have to help you make that possible. We have to teach you what we know and we can learn from you. But that's how things change for the better. We can just look at history. That's how things change.
That's amazing. It is quite an interesting time, I have to admit. It is really, really an interesting time. And the way you position it in terms of, no, don't just lie down and die, basically. You can build something. You know what, Alicia? If I decided a couple of years ago I will never start a business again. I co-founded like 23 of them. But if I do, I'll come to you for advice, honestly. I think you're such
a... We can build it together.
No, I can't keep up with your energy. That's too much. Too much. I'm an old man now. I'm an old man. Can I ask you something? So you've lived a life, you know, I normally close on a question about happiness. And I've noticed in your conversation that you've built a life that is almost littered with achievement. Like, you're constantly, you said it yourself, huh? You were collecting achievements. What are you doing about your happiness? What's your secret to finding happiness?
Steve Jobs was one of my heroes. And once a week, I've always tried to listen to his commencement address at Stanford.
Yeah.
And whenever I kind of feel like I've stopped and I kind of lose my way, I go back and listen to it. Where he said, he like looks in the mirror and whenever, like, you know, like, he feels like he's going a bit in the wrong direction, he's not happy and he's not focusing on the thing that means like his joy, his place of joy, he adjusts. And I think I've become very good at that. At the same time, I think I drive a lot of people around me crazy because my late father was this incredible man who didn't focus on money. He focused on people. And it's like in the book where during apartheid, like, there were so many people, like African people, that had no access to doctors. And he'd give away his medicine and his pharmacy for free. he put, you know, he had this crazy costume store and pharmacy, and he put on performances like in prisons and all these weird things my dad did, like to give back to humanity through the arts and through his knowledge as a pharmacist. And it's weird because he died when I was so young, but at the same time, I learned so much about living from him. And he was like this North Star that I've always had this alternate view of the world, which many people told me was wrong. Many people said, your father failed you. Your father didn't leave you a lot of money. Your father left you in debt. But when I went to my father's funeral, there were more people than I've ever seen in my entire life at that funeral. And it wasn't just wealthy people. It was poor people. It was immigrants. It was, you know, you name it, they were at that funeral. And it had a profound impact on my life, because I've asked myself more times than I care to imagine, who will show up at my funeral? And it sounds crazy that I'm relatively young, that I think a lot about my own death. But at the same time, I think the importance of how we live, the importance of our friendships, the importance of leaving things better than we found them, that drives me. And so at any point in time, if at anything doesn't feel like, I try my best, like through my meditation practice, and I have to focus on my heart center. You know, I've used mind health and those things in terms of heart mind coherence and that. But to lead from my heart, where, you know, that Maya Angelou quote, it's not about, people don't remember what you say, they remember how you make them feel. And if, when I see my founders smile, or when, you know, like, I feel like that's like the best feeling in the whole world, when, you know, like, hey, like I helped that person in some small way, and their life is better for it, whomever it is. That feels really, really, really good. And I think that's a daily practice that I don't take for granted. I made it a conscious choice. I go to certain classes with certain teachers every week because I know that they come from different cultures. They're not focused on capitalism. You know, they just like, they just like have like, I've got this one teacher from Brazil, and he makes me laugh so much because he's just like, he's living life. He's embracing life, and he creates joy, and he's light. And the idea of being around someone that creates so much light and laughter, and just there's like that radiance, it's important to be around that. It's healthy. So it's an ongoing, very, very, very important part of my life where it's not just about the capital. If it's just about the capital, you're going to be super unhappy. Like, I try to tell the founders, don't do it for the capital alone. Do it because you absolutely love it with every ounce of your being. And if you're doing it for free, you'd still do it. That's how much you love it. But don't do it for the capital, because you may wake up and you're not going to have the capital, and you're going to be lonely and unhappy and miserable, and your life's going to be over. So choose wisely.
I have to admit to you, this is the first time I get this answer. I find my happiness in leaving things better than I found them. That is so beautiful. It really is. I will openly tell you, for most people who ascend and ascend and ascend in their happiness practice, they eventually find out that this is what life is all about. Life will throw challenges your way. It will will throw luxuries your way. And the one thing that really makes us happiest is to leave everything better than we found it. So basically, just a tiny bit of positive impact on everything that comes your way. Just a tiny smile on every face that looks at you. Just a tiny bit better for everyone that crosses your path. That is so beautiful. I really have to say, you were so nice on LinkedIn. You're so much nicer on Zoom. I can't wait to meet you in person. Don't know if I can take all of the energy, but definitely one of the most wonderful capitalists I've seen in a very, very long time. Alicia, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you. I've loved every minute of this, and I hope we get to see each other soon in person. Come to the launch party. We're all going roller skating. Roller skating. Bring your family, bring your roller skates. All your listeners are invited. Again, just going back to unemployable, it's like, as you said, living your life on your own terms. So it's May 19, and I'd love for you to come to LA and come roller skating.
So LA refused to let me in a couple of months ago because I had the wrong visa type when I landed. But I will tell you and tell all my listeners, I'm a very serious roller skater. So you know what? I'll be roller skating here on May 19th for you. I think that's really, that is such a wonderful way to launch a book. I think that's the way to do it. Thank you so much for being here, for all of you joining us. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. I don't know if you feel Alicia's energy, you know, as much as I feel it. This is, I would say openly, a prodigy. I know intelligence. I know this woman is extremely intelligent. When we let you guys go, we'll probably be talking about math and physics. But when you find a heart that is so beautiful, that's trying to leave everything a little bit better than she found it, going through a path from extreme poverty to extreme success just because she was unemployable, I think is a wonderful, wonderful story. I am very, very grateful for the opportunity that you all give me to find such amazing people around the world that would give me an hour and a half of their time to have a wonderful conversation that enlightens me and hopefully enlightens you too. So whatever you're doing this week, I think you might as well take a little bit of time to slow down and think about how employable you really are. Trust me, I spent 27 years in the top jobs in the world. I'm totally unemployable. Slow down a little bit. I love you all for listening, and I will see you next time.